The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing and all things motorcycles. Today is Friday, December 7th, 2007. This is episode number 106. I am Bob Hayes, your host, here today to talk to you about MotoGP and motorcycle stuff. We don't have a whole lot of MotoGP action going on. This is the off season, the winter break, if you will, and the news on the MotoGP front. You know, there is news. There's news. Things coming out every day, but a lot of them, really, frankly, aren't all that super interesting. So we're going to cover a few emails that we had. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about a Laguna Seca sort of travel guide, some of the hints and tips that I picked up over going down there to Laguna Seca and stuff. I had an email listener, Adam Uribe, sent me an email, and he said, was there a paddock pass worth the cost, a few other questions, that sort of thing. So I'm going to cover that in detail. Then after that, I've got a, call it a tech segment, I guess. It's about buying a motorcycle for use on the track, whether you want to get into racing maybe, or you just want to do some track days and all that sort of stuff. Darren Carpenter up there, longtime MotoGPOD listener and OMRA club racer and participant in the Mustaches for Kids, by the way, which you guys have to see the pictures of Darren's mustache as he's growing it along. This is a fundraiser that he's doing for the Make-A-Wish Foundation, which is a fantastic organization that helps, you know, basically, let's face it, sick little kids do their, they get to make a wish. They get to do their dream of, you know, whether it's going to Disney World or whatever it is. And these guys help these poor little kids do their thing. And so it's a good cause. Darren's doing his Mustaches for Kids. I'm kind of rambling on here. But I just got an email today from Darren Carpenter showing his progress on his mustache that he's been growing here for a couple of weeks. And Darren can grow a pretty good mustache. He's got quite the porn star 70s looking mustache going on. Actually, what I think it reminds me most of is a cop. He has that look, not just a real cop, but what you think and what you see on the movies and all that sort of thing of what a cop should look like, particularly if the movie that you're talking about is something like Super Troopers. So I'm waiting to see the picture of Darren Carpenter guzzling a bottle of maple syrup. And Darren, if you're listening to that, that's what I want to see next time, because I think that's about the style of stash that you're going on, that you've got going on. And listeners out there, if you haven't considered supporting Darren in his fundraiser campaign for Make-A-Wish Foundation, send me an email and I will forward it on to Darren. And it's a good cause. It really is. It's well worth sending him, you know, $20 or whatever, not to Darren, but it'll be to the Make-A-Wish Foundation and all of that. And it's good stuff going on, and it's kind of fun at the same time with their mustache contest. So we've digressed enough talking about mustaches. Why don't we move on? And the first thing we've got is, I've got some emails here. The first one here is from Clifford Jones in Australia, and he says, "Hi Bob, thanks for the show. I watched Nikki Hayden on the MTV website last week," which I'll go ahead and put that link up again about the MTV website. If you haven't seen the Kentucky Kid, it's well worth watching. It's good stuff. But Cliff says, "I watched Hayden via the MTV website last week. I really enjoyed it. I'm not a Hayden fan, but I had to reassess my opinion of him after watching the show. He appears to be a humble man in his dignified way that he handled himself this year when the Michelins and the Honda were clearly not up to speed spoke volumes. It's also well known that Pedrosa is the chosen one, something that must really grate on Nikki, and I also noticed how lonely his life appears to be." Let me digress here real quick in the middle of Cliff's email, because that's true. I mean, Nikki Hayden seems like, if there's one guy in the paddock that is just sort of truly appreciative and almost truly sort of amazed that, you know, that he's getting to do this, that this is, that he's carrying out his dream of being a MotoGP racer. Yeah, that's Nikki Hayden. And the movie was like that. There was, you know, he seems like a very real person. And I think that his parents taught him very, very well that if you don't have something nice to say about somebody, don't say anything at all, because he's the perfect corporate guy. He really is. You know, he rarely speaks out against Honda, even though I think he's had times where it's been warranted to do so. But he's a good employee. I mean, let's face facts. That's what he is. And, you know, he does a good job out there. And it was good. It's a good show to watch, the MTV, the Kentucky Kid, to see him out there. The one thing, and I think I mentioned this last week, the one thing that surprised me and almost to a point appalls me is that the guy's been racing in MotoGP for how many years, and he can't even order a meal in Spanish. So come on, Nikki, get with the program. It's Hugo, not juice, Hugo. And to continue on with Cliff's email, Cliff says, I live in Australia, but hail originally from the UK. I have an interest in James Toseland. I listened to your comments regarding his testing performance with interest. To compare him to the other 250cc newcomers is not relevant, as he is learning a whole lot more than they are. Instead, take his times from Jerez and compare them to Colin Edwards. And now this is a whole different story here. And Cliff's right. I should have actually looked at this. I don't remember saying that Toseland was disappointing, but I may well have. This is referring to a later email that we exchanged with Cliff, that I said that apparently I said Toseland was disappointment and somewhat of an enigma. I still stand behind the somewhat of an enigma comment, and frankly, I don't remember the disappointment comment. Might have been too many beers that night. I don't know. But maybe I was meant that at Jerez, his times were not all that super spectacular over the first couple of days, and that, you know, wow, it's like, well, he didn't really jump out of the gate on that one. And this leads into, why is Toseland an enigma? He just is. I mean, the guy, he comes out and he just goes out and he puts in these laps where there's perfect times like clockwork, one after the other, and does very, very well, very, very consistently and all that sort of thing. So I think we're going to see some good stuff out of Toseland. It's just he kind of takes his time to go about doing it, and that's probably a good thing. And so Cliff sent me the times here. He's right. And when I did that last show, day three hadn't yet come out, so we only were talking about day one and two. I remember that. But on day one, Colin Edwards had a 140.790, and Toseland had a 141.776, almost dead spot on of a second behind the time. Day two, Colin had a 140.838. James had a 141.278. So Colin went up, a few hundredths of a second, which relatively speaking is very, very close. Toseland shaved off 0.5. Day three, Collins at 140.184, his best time of the 3-day test, and James Toseland's at a 140.213. So James had closed it down to within 0.03 of a second of Edwards' time while running last year's spec tires and apparently not even using qualifiers. So he was learning a lot. I mean, Jerez is not a track that Toseland's going to have a lot of experience on. He was on a new bike with a new team, lots of new going on there. And this sort of shows his progression. And granted, you know, this is a one lap out of the whole test day and all of that, but it did make a difference. I think that he was a full second behind Colin Edwards on the first day, and he had closed that gap up to well under a tenth on the third day. So we're going to see some good stuff out of Toseland. Like Jules and I talked about last weekend, James is actually a bit old to be coming into MotoGP, and it's going to be quite a difference for him from Superbike, the transition to MotoGP. But he's still going to be somebody to watch out for, and I'm really looking forward to watching him next year. And I hope that I did not mean to sort of denigrate him by saying he was a disappointment. So moving on. Got another email here that I'm going to cover real quick, and this is from Stuart Hicks, also in Australia. Got a lot of Australian listeners, very popular down there, MotoGPOD is, which I think is cool. It was real nice when we talked to Mark Braxton to see the forum down there, those guys talking about MotoGPOD and how they discovered it and all that, and Braxy's on the show and blah, blah, blah. I digress. Okay, talking about Stuart Hicks's email from Australia. Hi, Bob. Stu here from Melbourne, Australia again. I just wanted to say I completely understand what you were saying in your latest podcast, which is Like Suit Show, about the lack of domestic coverage of MotoGP. It's the same here in Australia, even with an Australian world champion and two others in the premier class. The television networks here are a joke, and they seem to want to play episodes of The Simpsons, Big Brother, Australian Either, and other mind-numbing shit, as long as the masses soak it up. And then they wonder why people appear to be being more stupid as time goes by. Maybe Big Brother is not the best thing to be playing for 2 hours a night. As for the amount of Australian Idol coverage, well, don't get me started. The argument I hear regularly here is that people aren't interested in MotoGP. The simple answer to that is that perhaps if it was not shown at 1 a.m. on Sunday morning every time there was a race, then maybe they'd have a fighting chance at being noticed. How do the network people ever think that the viewing numbers are going to increase high enough to warrant putting it in an earlier time slot if they always show it when people are asleep? It seems that on the sporting front, people here are force-fed Australian rules football in winter and cricket in summer. Both are as exciting as watching paint dry, but even in their respective off-seasons, the nightly news will spend around 8 minutes every night of a 30-minute news broadcast talking about the upcoming season. It drives me mad. I just don't know what else can be done to increase MotoGP's popularity. I mean, we already host one of the rounds of the championship, and an Australian has convincingly taken out the title. So, Stu, I agree with you, and I don't know what to say. Part of it, I think, is this always, it's going to be a bit of a inferiority complex that we have, because we know, as MotoGP fans, how good MotoGP is, and we just can't understand when somebody says that they're not interested in it. When you've got a guy like Peter Windsor, the Formula One commentator and all of that, and I remember once he said that he didn't follow MotoGP. There's just, you know, and he was saying it half jokingly, but, you know, truth will be told. It's, there's too much overtaking and all that sort of thing. It's like, dude, you're watching a sport, you know, Formula One. You got to be a fan, and you know, there's no overtaking whatsoever. It's all about the pit strategy and all that sort of thing. And this is your job, your life, and everything to be a Formula One commentator. And you can tell me with a straight face that you don't find a MotoGP race exciting. I don't know. So maybe it boils down to just different strokes for different folks. Maybe it boils down to the fact that with MotoGP being such a an international effort, that, you know, it's hard to find the racer that you want to get behind. You know, who do I root for? And that sort of thing. And that's something that people need. You know, they want to know, is this the guy that I want to win, or whatever sort of thing. And it takes time to sort of learn who the people are that you like. You know, we all regard these people as, you know, we know who they are, and whether they're from our country or from a different country or whatever, we sort of have a face and a name, and we know, you know, well, we want this guy to win or whatever. But even that, I've always been against the whole nationalistic thing in MotoGP, and just because, you know, this guy's an American, I'm going to root for him necessarily or something like that. That's not necessarily my way. I mean, even if there weren't four Americans racing in MotoGP, I would still be a MotoGP fan, and I'd watch these other guys out there showing off their talent, showing off their abilities and stamina and all of that sort of thing, just because it's exciting. I mean, it's good stuff. And I think that the Hungarian reaction to Gábor Tomaxi winning his championship is somewhat telling. I mean, it's just insane. This is a, you know, he's got so much of a following going on over there in Hungary, and yet Casey Stoner wins the world championship of MotoGP, the premier class, in Australia. And yeah, he's gotten some coverage. You know, I got to somewhat disagree with Stuart, just based on what I'm hearing from other Australians and what I've seen, not so much, you know, that I know, because it's not like I get Australian TV, but I've seen several links. I think Casey Stoner got a lot more coverage than Nicky Hayden did, that's for sure. So when Nicky Hayden won the championship, yeah, sure, you know, he's had some write-ups in the New York Times and things like that, and then we had the MTV show about the Kentucky Kid and all of that. But there was a lot more coverage of Casey Stoner when he won his championship down there in Australia than there was for Nicky Hayden when he was in championship over, you know, for us over here in the States. And this has got to be something that's a little difficult for these guys to deal with. And it was probably much worse back in the day when it was, you know, Kenny Roberts and Freddie Spencer and these guys that were winning the championships, because, you know, nobody over here knew who they were. You've got stars in Europe, like Valentino Rossi or whatever, can't even walk down the street without being just mobbed by fans. Whereas Nicky Hayden, just a relative obscurity over here in the United States. And again, you know, this is the life they've sort of chosen. They knew this going in, so it's not like some sob story for the racers, but it's still, it must be a bit weird to be in that sort of a situation. And another point that I thought about Stuart's email, or talking about the Kentucky, was it Stuart's email or was it, it was back to Cliff's email. I'm sorry, guys. was talking about how lonely the life was. And I thought that too. The same thing struck me when I was watching the race. And I mean, Hayden's lucky. He's got his family coming over a lot and everything. And Stoner has his wife there at all the rounds. And you know, his parents come out in quite a bit and all that sort of thing. But it does seem like that they are isolated, quite a bit isolated. And it does seem like a very, very lonely life. So, you know, this one of these things where, well, every silver lining has a cloud to go along with it, I guess, or something along those lines. It's it just seemed a bit odd to sort of watch that on the Kentucky Kid. So, all right, I think that will do it for today's so-called MotoGP news and email that we have. Why don't we get on with the rest of the stuff we have? First of all, we're going to talk a little bit about a Laguna Seca travel guide. Tickets for Laguna Seca have been on sale since November 5th, so hopefully if you guys are considering a trip to Laguna Seca, you are already considering buying those or you have already bought them. Be honest with you, I don't think there's going to be a sellout this year because of the second USGP and all of that sort of thing. Attendance wasn't down drastically in 2007, but you know they weren't getting those numbers that they had in 2005. I think people were a little bit scared off by the heat and all of that in 2006. It's definitely, though, you want to get those tickets early in order to get some of the options. So this all comes about, my little travel log to Laguna Seca, because I received an email from Adam Urabi. And Adam says, "Hello, Bob. I'm planning my first MotoGP trip for July," and he has a question about the tickets. "I would assume that a paddock pass is worth the additional funds, but I wanted to get your input on the subject. What are the advantages and benefits? And any other race or travel suggestions would be welcome, too. Thanks for the podcast. Keep up good work." Thank you very much for the email, Adam. And I'm going to talk a little bit about my experiences at – I've been to two of the three last MotoGP races there down there at Laguna Seca. One in 2005. I had tickets for 2006, but then my rich uncle called me up and said I had to go do some stuff for him. So unfortunately, I had to sell those on eBay, which I actually made money on. And then I went again in 2007. And the things that I've learned from those trips down there to Laguna Seca that are specific to a MotoGP race at Laguna Seca, and then other things that I've learned overall about attending various motorcycle races, including a GP at Donington and all that sort of thing, is that at Laguna Seca, the paddock pass is definitely, most definitely, well worth the extra money. Paddock pass this year will cost you an extra $50. So it's they've gone up quite a bit. I believe they were $25 in 2005, but they've this is a revenue stream for them, and they're wanting to make sure that you pay for that and all that sort of thing. But definitely get the paddock pass. If all else fails, a paddock pass is nice to have, because then on Sunday you can go from an area that is just insanely crowded and packed and go into the paddock area, which is only just mostly crowded. It's a break from some of the crushing mass of humanity. And you also get a chance to get real up close and personal with the teams and the racers, and you can look into the garages and all that. You can't actually go into the garage unless you're fortunate enough to have Jules along with you. But if you you can get real close, there was a barrier and you're looking at right in there, and you see the racers as they come off the track and do their thing and walk through, and there's autograph sessions and all that kind of good stuff that's kind of fun. Plus, over on the AMA side of the paddock, you can actually go wandering around and basically go right into these guys' pit tents that they've got set up and all of that. And they're all really nice people, really wonderful people. They answer questions, they talk to you, they take time out from their extremely busy day, to basically cater to the fans. I'm just super impressed all the time when I see these sort of things happening. And this level of behind the scenes action is unusual for a GP event. You typically you're not going to get into the paddock unless you have some extremely special ticket. So for $50, it's well worth the price of admission. The other point that I would make is go to all 3 days. Make a long weekend of it. You know, it's going to cost more money, of course, because of just, you know, the whole variety of things when you take a little mini vacation. But fun costs money, and it is a lot of fun. And to do all 3 days is a good thing, because Friday is such a low-key day as compared to especially to Sunday, and even compared to Saturday, that it's just the sort of pressure is off, and you have a lot more time and a lot more ability to get around, and it's just an all-around very, very enjoyable incredible day. You get to watch the guys out there on the track doing whatever on-track action that they've got going on, which, of course, for the MotoGP classes consists of the practice sessions, and you've got the AMA practice and all that sort of thing. But also, because it is less crowded, that's kind of a good day to check out all the vendor tents and things like that, or to buy your souvenirs or whatever else if you want to do those sorts of things. And there's fun on Friday night as well if you go into the town of Monterey and you know, you can meet people and party it up and all that good stuff. It's well worth the extra day to make sure you go to all 3 days. I would definitely suggest doing all 3 days. Don't try and just get away with Saturday and Sunday. You'll be happier with the three-day thing. It's not like I was ever sort of bored or anything like that. And if you're listening to this show, you're enough of a MotoGP fan that you're not going to be bored. So you will have a good time, and it's well worth the extra money. And you do get a big price break. Let's see, this year a 3-day general admission ticket is $90. You tack on the options and extras and all that good stuff, and the $50 paddock pass covers you for all 3 days. So if you just got a general admission ticket and a paddock pass, you're only looking at $140. That's not even $50 a day for the actual going into the circuit portion, and that's actually a good value. Once you start adding in the motel or camping or whatever it is that you do, yeah, it starts adding up more, but it's still, as a vacation goes, it's pretty good value when you compare it to something like, say, Disneyland or whatever like that, which will, you know, cost you a lot more. As far as camping versus motels and all that sort of thing, I personally prefer camping, but then I don't mind roughing it. When I went in 2005, there it was extremely primitive. Showers were so far away that, you know, I just didn't bother, and just camped for 3 days. I've gone for longer than 3 days without a shower. Wet ones are your friend. Bring lots of baby wipes, and basically you'll get by. You're happy, and that's fine. However, in 2007, the camping facilities, which I stay in the Archery Campground, which is at Laguna Seca. It's kind of down off the hill. It's in a flat spot. In 2005, this place was deserted. In 2007, very, very crowded. All the RV guys found it, and they realized that, oh, this is a flat spot. And they came off the hill, and they filled up my Archery Campground. I'm a tent camper, but I had a tough time getting there on Thursday night. I had a tough time finding a spot to set up my tents. It's a nice spot. It's just a grassy field, so it's not all that nice of a spot. It's very unimproved. Most of the camping at Laguna Seca is unimproved. The improved spots that they have are fantastic, wonderful campsites, but you have to basically be on a list from the guys that went there last year in order to even be able to purchase a ticket for that. So if you have an RV and you want the facilities and all that sort of thing, it's going to be tough. But you can just go on in there, park your camper in the archery section, and you'll find some level spots, and it's good stuff. If you go on Fox Hill or Toro or all of that, you might be on the side of a hill of a bit. It depends upon when you get there and how early you can stake out your claim. In a tent, it doesn't take much of a hill to make it extremely difficult, both difficult to sleep and difficult just to sort of live. You know, you think, oh, this is mostly flat, and you've got, you know, sort of a shallow hill sort of a thing. Yeah, you're going to wake up in the morning, squish down to the bottom of that tent. All your crap's going to be sliding down all the time. It's just very difficult. You want to find a flat spot. But this isn't a show about camping, so we're not going to go too much in detail on that. The reason that I like camping as opposed to staying in the motel is that you're right there at the track. I don't have to worry about traffic traffic. That's the main thing I don't have to worry about, is getting in and out of the traffic and all that sort of thing. At the end of the day, I can walk back to my campsite and basically, you know, take my shoes off or whatever it is that I want to do, crack open a tasty beer and start, you know, relaxing, having a good time with my fellow campers and all that sort of thing. And that's something that you somewhat lose out in a motel. Now, the motels in Monterey do fill up with people that are all at Laguna Seca, so you can find people there easily that are also there that enjoy, you know, MotoGP and everything, so you can hang out with them and have a good time and do whatever it is that you like to do in your relaxation time. But I still prefer the camping. Now, a camping pass at Laguna Seca is going to run you, for those 3 days, at least $150. But when you consider that a motel will cost you more than that per night, you're saving a lot of money, and you get that whole fun of roughing it. So I know people that do stay as far away as Salinas and everything, and there you're looking at a pretty far drive, actually farther away than Salinas, you know, and so the idea of driving in for an hour and then out for an hour at the end of the day and all of that is just not all that appealing. So I choose to camp. That's what I like to do. Let's see, other little tips that I found out about Laguna Seca and going to those. Definitely, I like a grandstand seat. Now, this is an option that is a personal choice, a personal preference. Laguna Seca, you have the hill that is where the corkscrew, the hill that the corkscrew actually comes down on. And if you sit on the side of the hill that's sort of closer to the pits and all of that, you can see a lot of the track. You can see turn 11 where they're coming onto the front straight. You can see portions of the front straight. You can see turn 1 and 2 mostly. You can see the 3-4 complex and then out into 5. But everything is very, very small. And also, everybody has a habit of standing up during the race. So that means you're standing and trying to look over people's heads and all of that sort of thing. And the distances involved are such that the bikes are little specks. It's very difficult even to see the timing tower. I advise you that if you don't buy a grandstand seat, bring a good pair of binoculars. On the other hand, with a grandstand seat, which will cost you, I think, $15 or $25 on race day and $15 on Saturday. And if you have that grandstand seat, you can just sit in the grandstand seats. I've been fortunate enough to be in front of the Jumbotron. They set up a Jumbotron, big giant TV on the back of a truck that's right across the track from you. And I've been sort of more or less directly across from that both years. So when you have on-track action right in front of you, you're watching that. And when the guys are all on the other side of the circuit where you can't see them, you can watch the race on television more or less. It works out real well for me. I kind of like the idea of having a seat that's fairly close. A road course typically means that you're seeing only a small portion of the track. It's not like an oval where you see the entire thing all the time. This is just the nature of the beast. And I would rather have a seat where I'm comfortable and I can see my small portion of the track and I can get up close. And the sound is just incredible. The sound and the smell. And if you're lucky and the security guards aren't around, you can go up there and hang on the fence and get really, really close to these things. And it's just, it's very, very impressive. But the hill is also a viable option. And when I say that I'm buying a grandstand seat, that doesn't mean that's like where I am the whole weekend. The only time I spent in the grandstands at all was, you know, during the race and a couple of times during the practice sessions and all that. I kind of go there and sit down. Most of the time I was running around, going back up and down, watch the race or watch the track action from like at the corkscrew for one session and then go over there to turn 11 as close as you can get for another session, that sort of thing. Just, you want to make sure you're mobile and going all over the place. A good spot to watch the race to get an idea of exactly how loud and fast and everything else that these motorcycles are is on the inside of turn 4. And you get there, and it's basically along where the vendors are and at, and you can sort of hang out, and you're really close to the track at that point, and they come around on the thing, and they're going right by in front of you, and it's just amazing experience. Do bring earplugs. It's insanely loud, and you'll be happier for them if you get any distance close to the track and all of that, especially for kids. You want to make sure that your kids have protection if you bring kids. And that, let's touch on kids real quick. Little kids at a racetrack, I mean, you guys are the parents. You guys know how your little kids are and everything, but it's a long, hot day out in the sun. Relatively speaking, somewhat limited water and all of that, and shade is somewhat at a premium and all that. I would want to consider, you know, bringing little kids. I'm not too sure if a race is the perfect environment, but, you know, they're your kids. You do what you want. And other than that, let's see. I think that that about covers it. The ideas that I have for the track from my personal experiences, but another option that you might want to consider is Steve Jones's suites that he has going on. Steve Jones has got at usmotogpfans.com. He's doing the suite deal. Now here in the suite, you're at Laguna Seca, at least you're right there above the pit garages on the front straight. You're more or less directly across from the start finish line. The suite itself is a room with an upstairs sort of balcony open area kind of a thing going on. Down in the room, there's chairs and seating and free food and booze and all that good stuff. They've got some TVs set up, so you're basically watching the race on TV and you're seeing the track through windows. Upstairs, out there on the balcony, you're outside and you're in there in the action. You can hear the bikes as they go by. The view is relatively limited, your actual true view. You know, you're seeing just a small section of the start-finished front straight and all of that. You could probably look over to your right and you'll see turn 11. But looking over to your left, you're not going to see turn 1 because of the hill. So, you know, it kind of depends on the experience that you're looking for. The suite is a cool thing. And if you're into that sort of thing, I encourage you to contact Steve Jones about it. Personally, for me, I sort of like the freedom and the roughing it thing and all of that. But definitely bring your sunscreen if you're out there in the grandstands. They are not covered. And you will be exposed to the harsh elements and all that sort of thing. So sunscreen, earplugs, sunglasses, all very good things to consider bringing to a MotoGP race at Laguna Seca. And that pretty much covers it for the tips on there. If you have more specific questions, if there's something I didn't cover or whatever, and maybe I can possibly provide you with an answer or whatever, I will definitely try, or I will ask other people what they think. So send them to me, bob@motogpod.com. I'd like to hear it. And definitely, no matter what you do, get those race tickets soon. Get those sweet from Steve Jones soon. Whatever it is that you're going to do, line it up soon. July is not that much farther off now. We're only looking at 7 months away. So the countdown has already begun for the Red Bull US Grand Prix at Laguna Seca. I've talked about my track days in the past. I think a track day is a fantastic way to become a better rider. Plus, if nothing else, it's lots of fun to be able to go around a track as fast as you can. No worries about coming around the corner and there's a car in the way or a deer or a pile of rocks or something like that. I mean, there are concerns, but all in all, a track is a much safer environment to ride your bike to the limit than is the street. So after the last track day I did, which was in October, went down there to Thunder Hill for a two-day event with the Pacific Supersport riders and hung out with Jules and Darren from Portland and all of that. We were down there. So after that track day, I sort of kicked around the idea of buying a dedicated track day bike, because one of my fears at the track day, one of the things that does, at least in my mind, whether or not this is true or not, but it does in my mind, one of the things that affects me from pushing it to the absolute limit is the fear of crashing my regular daily rider. My bike's a 2002, so it's actually getting a bit long in the tooth, but to me, you know, it still feels, it has that new motorcycle smell, and I really don't want to wreck it. So I'm possibly a bit sketchy about even the slightest, you know, off. I mean, even just not that even a low side, you know, the bike's always going to be damaged and it could be really catastrophic and all of that. So it's not like I'm saying that a crash is inconsequential. But if I had a dedicated track bike that was already all scratched up and dinged up and hopefully was track prepped with frame sliders and things like that, you know, these bikes can typically, they can go down and still be ridden. Sometimes that's not the case, but sometimes it is. You should have seen Darren's bike down there at Thunder Hill. He'd had a big crash a few weeks before, and he was riding his bike down there with no body work and all kinds of stuff. So it was pretty ugly, but it was still very, very functional. And so the thought for me of my regular street bike having that inflicted upon it is just too painful. And I know that there are areas where I'm just a bit where that's my overriding concern. It's not like I'm worried about being hurt. I'm just worried about the motorcycle being hurt. So if I could remove that feeling, at least to an extent, then I think that I could have an even more enjoyable time out there at the track day and get more out of it. So, like I said, thinking about buying a used bike. So, Darren, who races in the OMRA series up there in Portland, like I said, was kind enough to put together some tips and things. And he sort of originally put these together just as kind of to help me, and he didn't intend it to be a podcast segment and all of that. And I started to look through it. I said, there's a lot of good information here. And then Darren sent on a few more tips and things, and I just kind of edited it all together, and I'm going to turn it into a podcast segment. So we're going to talk a little bit about buying a used bike, or actually buying a motorcycle specifically for the track. We're not just talking about used. We're talking about buying a motorcycle specifically for use on the track, and some tips and pointers and the options that you have of how to go about doing something like this. So first of all, you want a bike for the track. You've established that. That's step one. So you've got several options, and we're going to go through them one by one, least or most expensive down to least expensive. Option number one is buy a new sport bike. They're all very, very good, and then you just take this to the track. The cost, of course, is going to be whatever the new bike costs, which typically nowadays for a 600cc, like an R6 or a CBR 600 or a ZX6R, that sort of thing, you're looking in the, $85,000-$9,000 range, that kind of ballparky thing. If you want to step up to the leader class, you're looking at $11,000 or $12,000. Just kind of depends on where you buy it, and you can probably find good sales and all sorts of things like that. But this is not a cheap investment. This is not something that you're just going to run out and spend a few bucks on. You're looking at a fair amount of money. You might want to consider, though, making some mods to this, which, of course, is only going to add to the bill. First off, race bodywork and a used gas tank, which is touching on my previous point that, you know, this way that you can take off your original factory stuff, your OEM stuff, you can put it in the garage to keep it all looking like new, and this you would have that for later to put it back on the bike to sell down the road or in any case, you know. And if you've already got the tanks all dented up, or if you've got race body work, which is made out of fiberglass and as opposed to the plastic that comes on a street sport bike, these are going to be a little less crash damaged by a smaller, you know, crash sort of a thing. So you're also going to want to think about upgrading the suspension, both front and rear, your brake lines to go from the sort of stock rubber to braided steel. You might want to get a power commander to touch on the fuel injection so that you can do mapping and all of that sort of fun stuff. A new pipe, which if you get a new pipe, you're almost certainly going to want to do something along the lines of the power commander. Your choices are a slip-on where you use the headers that come out of the exhaust and you just put the rear section of the pipe that fits onto that the header, or you can get a full exhaust kit, which is going to cost you quite a bit more. Or you can, and you might want to consider other things too, like a bit of an engine rebuild and all that sort of thing. Cost on this is going to be a lot to a whole heck of a lot, depending upon how far you want to go with this. Just for instance, the pipes and things, you're looking at starting off at in the probably $400 or $500 range for a slip-on to, you know, $1,100 or $1,200 for a full exhaust or more. All of this sort of stuff will add up very, very quickly. Darren says, I believe $50,000 will get you close to a factory AMA Super Sport race bike. I'd say that's probably a tad on the low side, but you're definitely getting into the ballpark. I mean, you know, you're looking at probably $20,000 at least in suspension alone on those factory bikes. The upside to option one is that you can sell the OEM stuff on eBay should you choose to do so. You know, a set of plastics and that new tank and all the thing will fetch a fair amount of money because that stuff is very, very expensive, ridiculously expensive when you consider that it's nothing but plastic. Or, on the other hand, after you're done racing or using this for a track day bike, you can put all that OEM stuff on back on the bike and then sell those aftermarket parts on eBay. And then you either keep your nice new looking motorcycle now as a street bike, or you can go ahead and sell it as a used motorcycle. Hopefully doing the full disclosure thing and telling your customer that it was a track day bike. And then also another upside of option one here is that with a new bike, you know exactly what you're getting. There's no questions about what might be bent or cracked or broken, and there's a variety of advantages to that. Plus, you're also looking at, you know, this year's performance, which it does every couple of years. These things go through a new generation cycle. Not sure what I was looking up for the word there. Downside to option one is, of course, that it's the most expensive, and also that if you buy a lot of aftermarket parts, you're going to need to either know how to install it all and set it all up, which is not going to be easy, or you're going to have to get, you know, pay money to have people help you out with this. It takes even a factory team a lot of time and a lot of testing to get everything working all together correctly, the setup that they want and all that sort of thing. So if you don't have help, you're never really going to get it exactly correct, exactly the way you want to do it, unless you are just a super expert, in which case you're probably not listening to this segment of the show because you already know what's going on. So that covers talking about buying a new bike, which I think realistically for most people, particularly for someone who's thinking about their first track day bike, you know, unless you just happen to go win the lottery, that's probably not the option that you're going to take. If you do take it, more power to you. I think that's great. And, you know, send me an email, tell how your experiences are working out. But let's talk a little bit about used bikes, which is, of course, the area where I have been considering. These are the options that I've sort of been thinking of what I want to do and kicking it around of the variety of different things that I can do to get a track day bike. So now this time of year, which is early December, you know, basically the end of the year, anywhere from, you know, November, December, maybe January the following year, this is a good time to buy a used track bike because the racing season is over and racers are looking to unload their old bike and get in a new bike for the following year. So you're going to find some deals out there on the various websites or on eBay or in the classifieds or whatever. It's just a question of looking around for them. I'm going to touch a little bit on my experiences so far on the looking after we talk about some of the options. But first of all, option number two, which I guess for the used bikes, it's option number one again, but whatever. Option number two is buy last year's well-funded, factory-supported team's race bike, which that's right, they all sell their bikes after the year's over. Now, the cost, he's seen them for as little as $10,000 and as much as $15,000 and up. And, you know, these are, seriously, the people that are getting a lot of factory support and all of that, and this is going to be a well-funded motorcycle. You're not looking at, you know, probably the Aran Honda or anything like that for $15,000, but certainly the smaller series and things like that, you're going to be in that kind of a ballparky range. So, yes, probably more than a new bike, but on the other hand, it's got a whole lot of modifications, and it's already set up, and it's all ready to go as far as a track bike. The upside, you look like a rock star in the pits, at least, Darren says. You get an almost new bike with all of the aftermarket stuff that you will ever need already installed, and you can be pretty certain that the bike was taken care of, well taken care of, and that everything is going to be in good working order. And that's going to be true. Of course, you're going to want to ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Downside, not street legal, and it will not come with any of those OEM parts to make it street legal, and I'm not even sure that it will come with a title that you could take to the DMV to make it street legal. This is basically always going to be a track day bike. It's still pretty expensive if you're looking for just a bike for track days, and you will still need to set it up for you yourself. That suspension was set up for someone else, which, let's face fact, is probably somebody weighs a whole lot less than you are and is a whole lot stronger than you are. And the motor was also set up for race fuel, which is extremely expensive. Most likely the fuel mapping will be zeroed out before you get that motorcycle because they don't want you to know anything about what they're doing. So, you know, you're going to have to worry about those things, but it will have the fuel injection mapping, you know, some sort of power commander type system and all of that. And you should be able to set that back up for either pump gas, or if you choose to run race fuel at I don't know, $10 a gallon or $15 a gallon or whatever it's running, probably more than that, then I suppose you can. Option number three is scan your local motorcycle club racers forum on the website. Scan their club racing forum classified sections. They all have them, classified section, buy, swap, and sell. And you're going to buy an almost new bike from one of the fast guys at the track. Now, these are not the factory guys. These are fast club racers. A lot of these guys are, in their own way, well-funded. So these are going to be good bikes, and the fastest club racers get new bikes every year, and they still sell their 1 or 2 year old motorcycle. So your cost on this is going to be somewhere ballparky, probably between $6,000 and $10,000. The upside to this is that you're going to get an almost new bike with all of the aftermarket parts. It's probably still in very good shape, and a lot of time they're still going to have those OEM parts because these are, you know, regular civilians that have day jobs and all of that, and they're just doing the club racing thing and on a sort of a well-funded effort. So they're going to gladly sell you those OEM parts, and all of that might add to the price tag, but it does add somewhat adds value to the bike as a whole because you can always turn it into a street bike. The downside, again, still pretty expensive if all you're doing is track days. And it will probably have a few more scratches on it, certainly than option number one, and probably more scratches than option number two. But it's a very viable option to go around to your local club, find out who the fast guys are in that club, and see if they're selling one of their motorcycles. Option number four is to take a look at the same forums on the websites or the classifieds and buy a bike from just anyone, pretty much. Buy one of the bikes from one of the racers at the track. On average, these people race for about 3 years, so it's pretty easy to find a race bike that's from 3 to 5 years old. Your cost is going to be anywhere, Darren's estimating, from $2,500 to $6,000, depending upon condition. Your upside's very reasonable price. You can get a really, really fast on a racetrack with a very big, capable bike that's already been probably quite well track set up. It's the best bang for the buck, and you won't feel so bad when you throw it down the track at 100 plus miles an hour, as long as you don't hurt yourself. His downside is you get what you pay for. Now, I'm going to add in option number five that Darren didn't specify, but in my research over the past couple of months, this has been the one that's coming up, and that's just buy any damn bike you can find used. Because I was kind of hoping for, when I started this whole thing a couple of months, that I could get in for around the $2,500 or do a stretch to $3,000 sort of a thing. So far, I'm not having a lot of luck finding anything that I want in that price range. I had a lead on a 2002 R6 the other day. So a 2002 R6 is a five-year-old motorcycle. It's already, you know, out of the range of being easy to find aftermarket parts for and things like that. And they were saying they wanted $2,500 for, and this was by far the cheapest that I had found a bike of that level for, and I was very interested. Got a little more information about it. It turns out it was a mess. Fairing stay was broken, frame was bent, just all around clutch levers smashed off, all kinds of stuff. This thing was probably not worth $2,500, and certainly not something that I wanted to get into because it was a project, a big project. So prices, Darren's pricing estimates might be, at least in my area here in the Pacific Northwest, might be a tad less, unless I just haven't gotten sort of lucky and it's that right sort of everything's falling into place where you find the right guy at the right time and you happen to have the money, he wants to get rid of the bike, and you get a good deal. Those deals are out there. If you look on the Bay Area, the BARF forum, the Bay Area Riders Forum classified sections, the prices are quite a bit less and there's a lot more to choose from. My downside is that in order to get that motorcycle, I'm looking at a several hundred dollar, either a trip down there or have it shipped up or whatever, you know, that this is going to cost quite a bit of money just to get the motorcycle. So I have to sort of consider those things as well. So that's my option number five, because I've had a little bit of an education and it's almost enough where I'm starting to get a tad discouraged. I haven't really been looking in earnest, but the prices are a little bit more than I had expected. On that same day that I was looking at that 2002 R6, there was a 2003 R6, all track prepped. I had all kinds of extra goodies. It sounded like a really nice bike, something that would have been perfect that, you know, wow, you know, this comes with everything. You've got, you know, pit stand. It's got all the parts and bits and race body work and stuff like that. So it would be a good thing to have. But the guy wanted $4,500 for it. And it's like, you know, that's getting out of the budget that I'm willing to spend. So it's been a little bit of an education. I'm going to keep looking and I will keep you posted as to whether or not I get a track day bike. Why don't we finish up a little bit here with some tips that Darren is passing on about buying a used race bike for the track. Here are some tips. Number one, ask the seller where they get their bike serviced. Most racers have a shop and or a mechanic who they're either sponsored by or they have a very good relationship with to get to do all of their motor work and all that sort of thing. Call that shop and ask them about the bike and what kind of shape it's in. You have to take everything with a grain of salt because, you know, this mechanic has got a relationship with a racer, so he might be telling you somewhat what he thinks the racer wants to tell you. But most shops and our mechanics don't really want to get a bad reputation, so they will give you the lowdown on a bike. If possible, have the bike taken to a shop or a mechanic, hopefully one that you know, and have them take a look at it. Number three, more popular bikes are easier to get replacement parts for or aftermarket parts. For example, Darren owns an RC51, which is a great track bike, but it was never a really popular race bike. They didn't sell huge numbers of them. So now when he tries to get replacement parts, most aftermarket companies don't even make parts for that bike, which is different, say, from a GSXR or an R6 or particularly the SV650. The SV650 has always been a very, very popular bike for this sort of thing and quite a good choice. So these are things you might want to consider. The popularity of the motorcycle all along, how easy is that thing to get parts for? Number four, older the bike is, the harder it's going to get to get parts for it. Either aftermarket new bits or replacement parts for things that you might damage or whatever. Again, most of the aftermarket companies only make parts for popular and current motorcycles. Number five, stock motors last longer. When the motors are rebuilt for more horsepower, they just don't last as long. Some mods are fine and will actually help the motor last longer, possibly. And some racers will specifically tell their motor builder that when they get their motors rebuilt and all that, they want it improved, but they don't want it pushed to the absolute limit. A builder can make a motor to last one race and then build it for peak performance, or they can build it to last and do endurance races and all that sort of thing. Darren had his SV motor rebuilt 4 years ago, ran it hard for 2 years after that, then he sold it to a novice who ran it hard for another 2 years, and it's still going strong. And it sounds like I need to get a hold of that guy and find out if he's got that motorcycle and wants to sell it. So this is true that, you know, if you push a motor, the engine itself, if you push it to the absolute limit, it's not going to last as long. Don't forget, a MotoGP motor is stripped down, completely disassembled pretty much after every session, not after every race. So the motorcycle is taken apart after every session. So these things are, you know, a lot of maintenance to get that much performance out of a motor. Lastly, if the bike looks good and clean and it looks like the owner took care of it, it's probably better than the bike that has grease all over the swing arm. It's never been washed. It has the, you know, unpainted bodywork or huge amounts of road rash or that sort of thing. And that's a good point. And this is true. You know, if everybody's bought used cars and that sort of things, and when you go look at a used car, you can kind of get an idea of how the guy took care of it, because usually, not always, but usually, if they take care of the appearance of the car, then they take care of the running gear of the car as well. And if they're taking care of the running gear, then they're going to at least do something to take care of the appearance. So these are things to consider when you're buying a used race bike or used any kind of used bike, actually. And also, don't be turned away by a salvage title. 90% of all street bikes that are crashed and totaled by the insurance companies end up getting turned into track bikes of one kind or another. Motorcycles are extremely expensive to fix, and when you make an insurance claim, they will give you the quote based on replacing every part that has, you know, even just minor cosmetic damage. I actually laid my bike down not long after I'd first bought it. This is back in 2002. Quote came back in at like $4,500 or something like that. It was horrible. The insurance adjuster called me and he says, look, he says, you got the swing arm. He says, there's a small scratch on the swing arm that's hidden by the exhaust and then also on the inside of the swing arm. If you choose to not replace the swing arm, we will waive the deductible. I called the mechanic and because I wasn't able to actually go and look at the bike, kind of a long story, but whatever. And I said, hey, how's this scratch looking? And he said, you really can't see it. He said, you're going to have to be looking for it to see this scratch. And so I said, yeah, fine, keep the swing arm, waive my deductible. But see, this is what I'm getting at, is that the insurance company was going to replace that swing arm, and that was like a $500 part. And so when they go and do an insurance the adjuster comes out and takes a look at that bike and does the insurance appraisal and all that sort of thing, they're going to bring that bike up to, you know, relatively factory new. And that means replacing everything that has the slightest amount of damage, even if it's cosmetic. So bikes get totaled very, very quickly because these parts are so expensive. Now, I'm not saying that a bike that's been totaled is always going to be some great sleeper deal. I mean, some of them are just trashed and you need a new frame and everything else. But on the other hand, it might have been totaled for relatively minor reasons. And if you buy it with a salvage title, perhaps from a reputable guy or somebody that you halfway know, he's put several bikes together and come up with a new good one. I do. I have a good friend that bought a salvage title ZX6R. He loves it. He's been riding it for years. He gets a lot of performance out of it and all of that. And he got a really, really good deal on it because it has that salvage title. Of course, he's got zero resale value on it. But then again, he paid very little for it. So this would be a good track day bike, something along those lines. All right. I think that about covers our track day bike tips. One thing is, on the suggestion of ideas of what to look for a track day bike, go with something along the lines of a GSX-R 600 or possibly an R6 or the SV650, as long as they've been set up for the track and all that with, you know, new front and rear suspension, that sort of thing. A lot of tracks that are technical and small and twisty, like Thunder Hill, where we went to in October, there's no real long straightaway to get a huge speed advantage and all that. A good rider on an SV650 is just as fast or even faster than an average rider on, say, like a GSX-R 1000. So, you know, learning to ride fast on SV650 is going to be also a lot easier than trying to learn on a big 1,000cc bike. So you don't need to go for the biggest bike out there. And in fact, sometimes that's even going to be detrimental to your fun and learning and all of that sort of a thing. So there we go. Hope that you get some help out of that. And if you end up buying a used bike for the track and you do a lot of track days and everything, I'd like to hear your experiences and see how that all turned out for you. And, you know, hopefully this episode kind of helped put some thoughts into order of some of your options. That's going to do it for tonight's show. Hope you enjoyed it. A little bit different kind of an episode today, actually. And also, I just almost had a beer emergency. I set my beer down on my little keyboard shelf, rollaway thing here on my desk. And apparently it's kind of slopey because I looked down and the beer was actually sliding off and had damn near fallen in my lap. So I reached out and grabbed it. Beer shot out of the top, splashed the computer, got all over the place. So I licked my computer clean, but we avoided the true beer emergency, I'm glad to say. But in any event, we are done with the show for the day. Like I said, I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you very much for downloading it. If you'd like to send me an email, it's bob@motogpod.com. And we're going to have some other stuff next week. I'm thinking of a few plans that I've got going on. I'm going to try and have some calls and some different stuff. I've got a couple ideas that I want to try out, and we'll see how they work out. And hopefully they're good, and hopefully you enjoy them. Definitely email me one way or the other if you say you hated it or if you say you loved it or whatever. And until then, why don't we say that I'll talk to you next week, and we're signing off. MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I'm solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.